Good morning, everybody. I'm going to call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Policy Committee to order for today being March 6, 2025. We are going to quickly dispense with the minutes. Lead Cleaver can't do that. Representative Sexton, would you like to move the minutes?
Motion to approve.
Representative Sexton moves the minutes from March 4th, 2025. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. So members, just by way of getting us prepared for what we're going to be doing today, Lead Cleveland and I had a conversation this morning. First and foremost, all bills are being laid over, and the budget forecast is coming out shortly. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic news, but we would like to be able to get the chairs and leads on this committee to the briefings that they're going to be taking. So we are asking both authors and testifiers to be brief. So we're going to try to give testifiers a minute to a minute and a half to testify on the bills. Again, we're laying them all over. So with that in mind then, Representative Davis, would you like to go to the testifiers table? As he's doing that, the chair will move House File 1809 come before the committee with a referral to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Davis, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nash. House File 1809, each year MMB has to give a legislative report by October 31st in regards to uncollected debt. The bill changes the reporting date, and I have someone from MMB here.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Nash and committee members. My name is Paul Moore, Assistant Commissioner of Accounting Services at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you very much, Vice Chair Davis, for authoring House File 1809. This bill, as the author mentions, moves the due date for MMB's submission of the annual uncollectible debt summary report from October 31st to November 30th. The legislature created this report in 2019, requiring MMB to provide a summary by October 31st of the number and the dollar amount of state agency uncollectible debts in the previous fiscal year. We've now submitted that report to the legislature six times, and we have found that the state's accounting staff are not able to collect all the necessary information until mid to late October. That same team of accountants is putting in extraordinary hours of overtime completing the state's audited financial statement. So it's created a workload pressure there. By extending the due date by 1 month, this bill provides our agency the additional time we need to transmit this report to the legislature. So thank you very much for your consideration of this bill, and I'm available to answer any of the committee's questions.
Members, any questions for the testifier or the author? Lead Cleaborn.
I just want to say thank you. I know that I have called and said, what does this report actually mean? And your staff has been very good about walking me through the different line items. So I want to say thank you. And I just want to make sure that I'm really clear about this. By moving it to October or November 30th, you're saying that this will help reduce the overtime costs that are incurred by the agency?
Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleaborn, the staff put in uncompensated overtime.
Okay. That's okay.
Cleaborn.
Just reducing the need to stay overtime is important to me as well. All right. Thank you. There's no free here, whether it's your time or whether you're being paid, it costs. Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Representative Davis.
Please give your support.
Okay. With that, Chair renews his motion that House File 1809 be laid over. All right. We do not have Representative Freiberg, so I'm going to go and present my bill. Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm going to move House File 1754 come before the committee and be laid over for possible inclusion. And members, today is the day that we will be hearing the budget forecast. If you remember and harken back to the November forecast, we were told that we're looking at a roughly $5.1 billion structural deficit. Today is likely going to be bigger than that. And 1754 is sort of a conversation starter. That's why we're laying it over. But we will be having to make some tough decisions as we move forward as chairs, leads, and caucuses as we work together to get this thing landed. And the genesis of the bill is looking at open jobs that have not been filled for over a year. And if we're having to look for cuts, that this is a place that is not not a bad place to start. So if you look at the bill, it is just that. It is for jobs that have been open for longer than a year. And my supposition is it's easier to look at a job that has not been filled, and if you're going to make cuts, rather than have a job that is currently being filled to cut that job. So I understand that there are some folks who would like to testify from agencies. We can move to that, Mr. Chair.
Please state your name and who you're with for the record.
Good morning. Please be brief.
Morning. For the record, my name is Dory Leland. I'm the Enterprise Director for Employee Classification and Compensation in M&B. There's three primary reasons why a position would be open for an extended period of time. The first reason has to do with client population. Some of the positions that are hardest to fill are the therapists and counselors that work with populations in the prisons and state hospitals. It always takes a special talent to find folks willing to do that work, but they're also often located in locations where it's just hard to find. They have smaller labor pools, and so it's hard to find employees. Second category has to do with positions where it's a very specific specialized skill set, like a subspecialty within hydrology. And again, if it's in a location like Ortonville, it just makes it, it compounds our challenges in filling those type of positions. Third type of positions that are open for an extended period of time are what we refer to as continuous postings. They don't have an end date because there's always a need for example, general maintenance workers or certified nursing assistants. And so the position may appear as if it's been vacant for, you know, 6 months or a year, when in fact we may have hired 40 people during that period of time, but it wouldn't be evident by looking at the report. What's important to know in each of these three instances is that the fact that a position hasn't been filled doesn't mean there have been any actual savings. So if the work has to be done, we've either had to pay a contractor at a significantly higher cost than the salary, or we've had to pay overtime to existing staff, which has obviously not only the salary cost, but the less quantifiable costs in terms of employee morale and turnover. Finally, I want to note that this is actually a pretty rare circumstance. I reran the report this morning, and so for the non-continuous type of postings that have been vacant for a year or more, there's only 7 as of 30 minutes ago, and so this isn't something that happens very often. And then we have at this time about 25 of those continuous postings that are just remain open all the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dory Leland, for your testimony. Somebody else here to testify? Please state your name and who you're with for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. My name is Ethan Vogel, Legislative Director with AFSCME Council 5. We have some concerns with this bill, and while some progress has been made in recent years to make Minnesota the employer of choice again, we're not there, and I think this moves us in the wrong direction. So specifically for the Department of Corrections and direct care and treatment facilities that have to operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, they're notoriously difficult to reach and maintain a full staffing complement, and the use of overtime is a real threat to everybody who works there. The use of overtime and the use of forced overtime are two completely different things. And the use of forced overtime in these settings has a very, very chilling effect on the staff morale. And it's something we want to avoid. And it's hard to overstate how fragile staffing can get once forced overtime becomes regularly necessary. It's a vicious cycle where every week and every month gets worse than the one before as people make the tough decision to leave the work for a more predictable schedule. So the nexus to this bill, Mr. Chair, is that I see that any unspent appropriations at the end of a fiscal year are appropriations and resources that could be available for us and the employer to negotiate an MOU incentive to incentivize overtime when it's necessary versus forcing that overtime on the same small group of people. And so for that reason, I would oppose this and would ask for you to do the same. Thank you.
Next testifier, state your name, who you're with.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. Just to build upon some of the previous testimony and highlight two specific instances, currently at Moose Lake, we have about 50%, 55% staffing levels. So a requirement to pull down the posting within 12 months. is just unfeasible to continuously hire. They have a 20% turnover rate in direct care and treatment. The other thing that was touched on was it's not just ongoing hiring, but also for multiple position postings where they're trying to hire into multiple positions using just one job posting. So having to pull down the posting while an applicant is still in the process would create unnecessary confusion of whether or not they're still an applicant being considered for the position. Also impacted would be Department of Revenue, which has seasonal hiring, particularly during tax season, as well as student positions. Thank you so much.
Two-member discussion. Representative Kraft, you're up.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hadn't even raised my hand yet, but wow. Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Nash. I appreciate the concern on cost questions. And I noticed in the bill that you had put an exemption in for anyone needing to undergo law enforcement training. Can you explain why you made that exemption?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll get you trained on that. We're already understaffed on law enforcement, and we need to make sure that we have full complements of them. There are so many different areas of law enforcement that are understaffed, and that was one of the decisions that were made. And again, this bill is being laid over. We're going to be working on it, so we can look at different things, but that was the rationale.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Nash. So I appreciate it's being laid over. I think you just made the perfect argument against why your bill here and why we shouldn't be doing this, especially if you add in the comments that were made. I mean, you know, we've been understaffed in nursing in the past. What if we were understaffed in veterans-related issues or in our folks that address fire and other disaster-related issues? So while I appreciate the focus on this, I think you've just argued for why this kind of thing doesn't make sense. So I look forward to talking about it further.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Representative Nash. As an agilist, I love the idea of being efficient and finding ways to cut things down, and I appreciate the idea of simplicity as well. However, I'm a little bit concerned that this bill is a little like taking a sledgehammer when a tap from a hammer will do. And one of the main reasons I'm concerned about that is that I think you and I both know that one of the largest unfilled skilled vacancies that we see across the board is particularly in the area of cybersecurity. In 2013, we had 1 million openings in cybersecurity. By 2021, that has grown to 3.5 million openings and has held steady over 23 and 24. 750,000 U.S. industry employees are going through turnover and burnout and needing new talent. We know that the number of those vacancies is increasing, and we know that because you and I have talked about this need to really build our pipeline of cybersecurity professionals. And among the others behind cybersecurity that are often going unfilled are things like specialists in the cloud, software developers, and folks in AI, as we're on the precipice of literally an AI revolution. And so I guess my concern is that just simply saying that we no longer need these positions and cutting them off the rolls because we can't find someone to fill the vacancy might not be in the best interest. And not only that, there was a number of research studies by a company called Equinix who does a lot around IT infrastructure, and 62% of their executives said that the most pressing issue that they have is that they cannot find the cybersecurity professionals that they need to fill these jobs, and they view that as the largest threat to their business. So, and I just want to rephrase that, largest threat to their business. You and I know how important that is. And I would hate to see us be knocking things off and saying, well, we just don't need that anymore because we can't find someone, and discouraging them from looking for that position. For that reason, I would suggest that we might need to consider some other ways in which to get at this problem a little bit more delicately. Thank you.
Chair Nash, any comments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly understand your perspective, and I would disagree with your analogy to a tack hammer. In November, the Walz administration forecast a $5.1 billion structural deficit. In January, they talked about that the then supposedly February, but now March forecast was going to be larger structural deficit. A tack hammer is not going to solve a $7.1 billion structural deficit if that's what today holds. And we don't know, but we're going to learn shortly. I certainly think that we need to be cognizant of how we got here. There were spending decisions that were made over the last 2 years that put us into this position. And now we have to reconcile how do we get out of this position, because by law we have to balance our budget at the end of or for this biennium. We're looking at lots of different options, Representative Bonner, and I think that this is something that is a conversation starter, and I certainly hear your points. But when you, let's say today is $7.1 billion structural deficit that we hear. A tack hammer is not going to fix that problem. Again, spending decisions were made in the last biennium that were even forewarned against in the then 2024 forecast. We took the briefing early in the morning for Republicans. It was at 6:45 in the morning, which was brutal. But they said if the majority party, then you all, don't spend beyond this certain amount, we might be able to avoid a structural deficit. That number was $250 million in the second year of the biennium. There was more than $250 million spent in the second year of the biennium, and now we are looking at a structural deficit. So the solution is not going to be benign. It's going to have to be somewhat abrupt, I believe, if we're going to get to the point where we can balance our budget. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up? Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, and I certainly appreciate all of that. But I do want to remind everyone in this room that our checkbook is full. Our reserves are at the highest level they have ever been historically. We have a top-notch credit rating, the envy of all of our neighbors currently. And when we talk about the deficit, and we can certainly argue this more later today as we get those numbers, but I just also want to be cognizant of the fact that the largest drivers behind the increases in that structural deficit in the tails are things like spending on long-term care, disability services, and special education. They are not poor decision-making. They are things that are talking about actual human need, where the cost of those items have been going up. And they have been going up significantly more than anyone could have forecast. And so I think we just have to be careful about how we talk about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, the November forecast was a negative $5.1 billion structural deficit looming on the horizon that we have to solve today. I anticipate, once again, as do a number of other people. I can't attribute them, but I saw several of the people from the administration, and they, without saying it, gave me the look of, oh, this could be quite bad. The reality is structural deficits have to get solved. And again, spending decisions were made. We now have to reconcile how to handle them. So thank you, Mr. Chair. If there are no further questions, or
yeah, we'll wrap up member discussion with Lead Cleaborn.
Thank you very much. And I would like to level set, and I'm not going to hammer on about the bill because you and I've already talked about what we think. I take a scalpel approach, and this is a very wide approach. So you and I will have that discussion as we move forward in the bill when it comes back. However, I do have to level set. You were talking about structural deficits in the out years, years that we are not covering at this particular time. The DFL trifecta is leaving at the end of 2024-25 a DFL surplus of $3.7 billion for the biennium. There is a $3.5 billion budget reserve that we have to work with, and we do have a AAA perfect credit score, as Representative Bonner talked about. What we don't know, and what it could really hammer our state budget, are the Trump-Musk inflation indicators, which could be the very worst yet to come. The U.S. House GOP just voted for massive cuts to Medicaid, which could have a real deficit problem in our state, so that we can give $4.5 $1 trillion of tax cuts to the wealthiest in our country. That is the real level setting, and that is the real budget buster. The uncertainty to our agricultural community, the uncertainty to those who can least care for themselves is a real problem that we may have to face in our state. We do not have the ability to backfill all of the Trump-Musk cuts that are on pause right now. So we have a lot of issues that could be facing our state. And as I said to you earlier today, I'm not going to try to guess what the budget forecast will be. I'm going to listen to the experts and then make decisions accordingly based on fact. We are going to have a problem with this forecast because this forecast does not take into account the Trump-Musk decision policies. And so the numbers that we hear today are going to be based on past, not future, and the future is what we have to budget for. Thank you.
Chair Nash, would you like to follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will thank Lead Cleburne for making my point that this is dealing with past decisions and that whatever number is presented today is as a result of the DFL trifecta, as you called it, making those decisions. So,
it's incorrect,
Madam
and that
Chair,
is not
you are,
what I said.
I have the floor, Madam or Lead Cleburne, so you do not, and I am the chair.
But you may not misrepresent my statements.
Lead Cleburne, let's suspense with the interruptions. Chair Nash.
And once again, I will point out that it was the Walz administration that laid out in November that it was a $5.1 billion structural deficit looming on the horizon. And today they will release what the next forecast holds. So these are conversation starters that we have to have. These are things that we have to leave on the table and things that we have to take into consideration. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I'll be heading back to my chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we will be laying over House File 1754.
So now we will call President Freiberg to the test, my voice carries, to the testifiers table to talk through his bill, 1478. And Representative Freiberg, as you know, we're going to be laying this over for possible inclusion. And since you're a member of the committee, you can make the motion that comes before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 1478 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg, to your bill.
Sure, thank you. So the public land survey system predates the state of Minnesota, and it creates our system of property management. There's been 150 years of neglect, which has taken its toll, and flaws are becoming worse. And when you don't have a accurate system of surveys and survey corners, it leads to lawsuits among private property owners, and there's a lot of uncertainty about where property boundaries lie. There are 325,000 PLSS monuments set in Minnesota. Less than half of them, or 148,000, have a known location. Counties have the authority to determine where they're located. The cost to locate them is approximately $1,800 per monument. More precise data creates informed records for land management accurate taxation. So we set up this program last year to create a grant fund where counties can more accurately locate the survey corners. This bill, House File 1478, builds on that. It sets some additional criteria that counties can use. It enables tribes to access the program, and it creates and it continues to fund the program. It has bipartisan support. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for signing on to this bill. In the Senate, Senator Ann Johnson Stewart and Senator Andrew Lang are the authors. I've heard a lot of very worried statements about the impending budget forecast. I'm extremely optimistic. I think we're going to have an awesome forecast.
I love your sense of optimism.
Yeah, this does seem like a lot. So we'll see where it falls. But
Representative Freiberg, would you like to move your A1?
Yes, I have the A1. This was an issue that was caught by nonpartisan staff, it just puts the bill in the shape I'd like.
Representative Freiberg moves the A1 to put the bill in the shape of the author wishes. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? To your bill as amended.
Thank you. I have a testifier here, and would love
to. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Preston Dowell. I'm Deputy County Surveyor for St. Louis County, also past president of the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors. Thank you for having me here and allowing me to talk about the positive impact that House File 1478 can make for Minnesota. As Representative Freiberg talked about, the PLSS allows us to precisely describe the location of all the properties in Minnesota and provides the foundational layer for all the geographic information systems and online maps that many of us use today. Of the 325,000 monuments that Representative Freiberg talked about, we only know where about half of those are. And if we don't know where those are, it's very difficult to update our maps and make them spatially accurate. House File 1478 will help us continue the progress to get this important work for Minnesota done. Preserving the PLSS in Minnesota offers numerous benefits. It enables us to secure property transfers, reduces time and costs on development projects, road projects, all kinds of different work that's going on out there. Many property disputes arise due to the lack of PLSS monumentation, which leads to expensive lawsuits, title resolution cases, surveys, all kinds of different things. Quite simply, the continued deterioration of the system will continue to lead to more disputes. Better location of these monuments will enable us to update our maps with more accurate data and improve land management and ensuring that our taxation systems are being properly spatially accurate. If you have any other questions at this time, I'd be happy to take them.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
I'll be brief. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know we've had conversations about this bill in the past and the importance of this work. And in particular, it was really intriguing to see a walkthrough of how these markers work, where they're placed, and sort of all of the history behind them. So I think while it's probably a very underappreciated bill, I would suspect that it is also extremely important for Minnesotans. So I appreciate the work.
Representative Sexton, briefly.
And very briefly, I will be signing on to this bill. I do have some experience in pipeline survey, and it's very expensive. And the more monuments we have will make things not only more accurate, but much cheaper for the landowners when they need to get a survey. So I will be signing on to the bill.
Okay, anybody else? I could probably fit in one other testifier as we're trying to move through things. So Mr. Raines, if you would like to come forth. And I'll just say as he's doing so, as a GIS guy, I appreciate these things. But again, we have to look at the whatever happens in the next hour or so with the forecast, and we'll deal with the practical reality from there. Mr. Raines, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, my name's Phil Raines. I am representing the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors today. Thank you for hearing this bill. This is very important. I always like to go back to a fundamental here. Even the most strict libertarian out there knows that we need to take care of public safety, we need to take care of property rights, and we need to settle disputes in the courts. This is one of those fundamental obligations, setting out the land values, where things are, and this makes your maps more accurate. And as Governor Walz said, I've got a video sometime if you want to see it. Good maps save lives, and it's a reality. It means it saves people money. It can bring down the cost of an $8,500 survey down to $2,500. And when the price goes down, people are more likely to do the survey and know where their land actually is and avoid those disputes going forward. And that's really what we're looking forward to here. So. Appreciate your time. Again, happy to take questions.
Okay, seeing none. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I was lucky enough last fall to be able to actually accompany Mr. Dowell and some other surveyors in northern St. Louis County and was just incredibly impressed with the professionalism and knowledge that they brought to the process. I think this is a bargain. It's something that's really needed, and I appreciate the committee's consideration.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. I do agree that it's something that we need to make sure we can get to, but again, we're going to have to react to the practical realities of the budget forecast. So Representative Freiberg renews his motion to have 1478 as amended laid over for possible inclusion. All right, next we have Representative Anderson, P.E. and she will be coming to talk about House File 1. Maybe. Representative Anderson, I will let you know of the conversation that Lee Cleaborn and I had that I had sort of intimated to you last night. I know that you and she and others are working on your bill. So today, if you would, give us an update on what's changed since this bill left committee. And again, to make good on my promise of whenever that was, we were here first. Given that there is no fiscal note, we are not going to be moving this bill out of committee until there is a fiscal note. But I know that you have been working on that. So I will move House File 1 to come before the committee, and you can proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Nash. I know you have a full agenda, and I'll give a brief update on what's changed since I was here a couple weeks ago, whenever that was. First of all, let me just start and say we've been meeting. We've had great meetings. Thank you for your help and Representative Norris and others. We've been meeting with the Senate at least weekly and actually more often behind the scenes to work through this. This is a bipartisan bill. This needs to be bipartisan, and the goal is to have 134 votes up on the board by the time we're done. Very briefly, we did align the staff with the Legislative Auditor's Office. Generally, the top deputies are in the unclassified service, and the rest of the staff is in the classified service. And so there is still an issue. There's still a little controversy with MAPE and whether those staff are represented, and that's being dealt with. We did more of the separation of powers. The original bill had statements like required to do things within the administrative branch, and now it's recommend. There's been a lot of data practices talk. This was amended in judiciary. There is a ongoing discussion with the Senate, and we pretty much have come to agreement on most of it, but there is a few little minor things that still need to get dealt with. There was a provision added that there's essentially a report that's required to the legislative branch that was not in the original bill. And the biggest section is the exceptions within some of the departments. So Human Services, this fourth engrossment essentially says we're not moving any corrections staff. And there's exceptions in the bill in regards to MDE and Human Services where it's laid out which positions will be staying within the agencies versus going to the OIG. We're meeting ongoing. Hopefully we can clarify tonight about the new children and families positions, which need to stay within the agency. And it's a federal, issue about oversight. And that will be added into the bill also as it comes through. And I'm going to leave it at that and just take some brief questions. So.
I will say I appreciate that you're working with your colleagues here in the House and that you're speaking to the Senate. And for new members, when you speak to the Senate, it's always best to speak slowly and use flashcards. member questions. Lee Cleaborn.
I just want to make sure that if anyone on our team wanted to ask questions, that they go first and then I would close. Did you want to go?
Representative Howard raised his hand, so we'll let him dive in. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. I still have concerns about this being housed in the legislative branch. Are there any other OIGs structured throughout the country in this fashion?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Howard. There are none that I know of. The OIGs vary amongst the states, but there are very few that have a legislative auditor within the legislative branch, too. So we have that because it works. That's an ongoing discussion with the Senate. We're pretty set, at least I am, that this needs to be done like we do the legislative auditors because it works, because it's nonpartisan, because you don't have that influence and pressure from essentially an administrative branch that's hiring their own inspector general. which I think has been the problem so far that we've seen. And so that's, you know, we do things a little differently in Minnesota, but we tend to do them better.
Representative Howard.
Have you looked at the federal model for OIGs? As I understand it, in the federal model, it exists within an executive branch but maintains independence. And they've found more than $70 billion in financial savings. What about that model isn't something we'd want to
replicate?
Thank you, Representative Howard. I'd say a couple things. First of all, as you are probably aware, President Trump came into office and fired a bunch of the OIGs. Okay, so from your side of the story. So that gets to the exact point that I'm, you know, talking about. We need to have independence. We cannot have a governor, you know, president, whatever, come in and dictate what the OIGs do and don't. And this would allow that to stay within the legislative branch. We are the entity that that allocates these dollars. We set up these programs. The administrative branch is supposed to carry them out. That's their job. But we're the ones that they should be responsible to.
Representative Howard, final thoughts from you?
Yes. I'll just make a few final comments. First, I appreciate you referencing what happened with President Trump. You know, and it does beg the question, if the OIG in the federal government has found $70 billion in savings from fraudsters, why would President Trump seek to remove them? So I appreciate that acknowledgement. And just a few other just brief concerns. You know, I still have deep concerns about the data pieces. We had a conversation about that. There's still very broad powers in here. Mm-hmm. And again, when you look, if the idea is let's not replicate what's happening at the federal government, you know, we've seen Elon Musk and Doge release private information, release classified information. And so finding at least some level of accountability against that, I think, is really critical and is still missing in this bill. You know, and ultimately, just how it's structured still has huge constitutional challenges. So I appreciate it's back. I appreciate that there's some changes here, but there's a lot more changes, I think, that are needed.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Let me respond quick. First of all, the federal government, I can't remember the agency, but they've actually said that they suspect is about half, $500 billion in fraud. So very little of it is caught by the OIG as it exists within the federal government. Let me point that out. Here in Minnesota, we had OIG set up in a couple of the agencies, and the fraud was not caught up front. We have the worst, you know, fraud in the country here in Minnesota, we have seen. And there's a lot more, and it's coming out, and I'm on the fraud committee, and it's insane what's happening here. So it hasn't worked. And so that doesn't, you know, my point about Trump, what Trump did with the OIGs is that you have to have a separation of power. You cannot have, you know, the executive overseeing.
Members, I'm going to just redirect our conversation to Minnesota since we're not in the federal legislature.
Okay, thank you. And the final thing on the separation of powers, we've had nonpartisan staff at our meetings in the joint, and they have actually said that the House version does not have issues with separation of power, and the Senate version does. So I just want to point that out. So thank you.
Lead Cleaborn has a comment.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask our team. This bill, Lead Nash and I have discussed that this bill is not moving out of this committee. Mm-hmm. If we have further questions, we can come back on another day and discuss it before it would leave our committee. So I'm going to ask you if you have constructive comments, make them short and brief. And I want to make sure if Mr. Bruce wants to testify that we have time for his testimony. So, yeah. And then we'll.
And actually, my apologies, Mr. Briggs, if you'd like to go and give us your testimony briefly, and then we'll move back to brief member comments. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Devin Bruce with MAPE. As I've already testified in many committees on this bill, I'm just going to keep it to some of those more salient points. We want to thank Representative Anderson for addressing some of the concerns around classified versus unclassified service. The one thing that we do still have pretty strong opposition to is moving it to the legislative branch, as it effectively strips them of collective bargaining rights. No matter how you address it, currently under state statute, under 179A, both the public employer and public employees are not qualified under this if they move to the legislative branch. The other thing that I wanted to also point out is the if we're truly looking at this and bringing it back, that we consider a strong investment in the AG's office. A lot of the fraud that has been detected has happened in the Medicaid area, and due to the backlog of cases and as well as the entitlement of these funds to the recipients, there needs to be a criminal investigation that's opened before you can stop payment. And we found that with the MDE case when the Ramsey County judge ordered MDE to reinstate the payments to Feeding Our Future. So just wanted to highlight those points. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. I will move to Representative Bonner, I believe, if you briefly.
I can hold it till next time.
Okay. Representative Kraft.
I'll make a brief
thank
comment.
You.
So I appreciate that there's a lot that there's things we can do mm-hmm. on this. And we're hearing a lot of things we can do. What I haven't heard effectively is that what we would do would actually matter, connected to the fraud that has occurred, some kind of connection that this thing will be different other than we're going to create a new bureaucracy in the legislative branch. So I would really urge us as we think about fraud in Minnesota that we actually like connect it to what's happened and how proposals will actually do something different.
Lead Cleburne to close for members.
Yes, thank you. And Representative Anderson, I'd like to thank you for your collaborative efforts in this bill. So House File 1, I just want to be really clear to the members on the committee. House File 1 is full. It has no more space for authors, and it is completely a GOP-authored bill. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that that's clear. We are working together, and so I want to make all of my comments in the effort of collaboration. So in hearing about the collective bargaining piece, that would be very difficult for our side of the table to strip collective bargaining. That's not something that we tend to do. We still have no idea what the exact... I mean, we all want to stop fraud. We know that, right? But the conversations between the Senate and the House are differing in the goal and purpose of these bills that are moving forward. So we need to get some alignment on the goal and the purpose of the bill. In this current bill, one of the things that I'm very concerned about is that if you misrepresent facts, i.e. lie, to the OIG, it becomes a misdemeanor. Currently, if you are sworn, that would be a felony. So we need to think about what we really want the penalties to be. The other concern that I have mentioned time and time and time again is that if this is housed in the legislative branch, there is no real teeth to Mr. Bruce's point this morning, and he and I had not talked about this previously. We can make recommendations, but we have no ability to intercede and change. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that everyone needs to be really clear about. If it's under the legislative authority, it's neutered. And that is not what any of us want to happen. So it would mean that we would have to increase the AG's budget and put those investigators in the AG's office where they could actually do something. So that's a piece that we have to work on. Yesterday, in meeting with social workers from across our state, one of their concerns was in the data practices piece. If you receive state money and you are doing domestic violence, all of that data is now public. So there's no way for the entities to protect any misuse of that data that could actually harm the clients they're trying to serve. So we'll need to make sure that we are protecting victims of domestic violence. The other thing is we have to figure out, are we really trying to oversee agencies with this bill, or are we really trying to prevent fraud? My goal is always to prevent fraud, and you and I have had that conversation. So I look forward to our continued work together. I heard you say you're working on it again this evening. The bill in front of us is the third engrossment. I think you mentioned the copy that we have is the third engrossment. So I'm not going to go to the details of the bill, but we are on a fourth engrossment. There may be a sixth engrossment. I don't know. So let's continue our good work together. Thank you.
And I'll just say that the having the wrong engrossment in the packet was just a simple printing error. When you have so many engrossments, it happens. Representative Anderson to close.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Claiborne. We're meeting with children and families at 4 o'clock in a conference room. somewhere, Representative Norris and I and anyone else that's interested. So just to finalize that. So again, thank you. This has been, we have to do this right, and we have to do this non-bipartisan. And so that's my goal. That's the way I've been dealing with this over the last, 3 weeks, and that's what we're going to continue to do. So thank you.
Okay. And members, with that, House File 1 is laid over, and we are adjourned.